Well, it is a great pleasure for my latest Nostalgia interview to meet Rhiannon Grant. And great to see you, Rhiannon. I think for the first time in probably about 7 years since we first met.
Yeah, certainly it's been a while since we last had time for a proper conversation.
And I remember it was a conference, and conferences are always great because suddenly you realise that you're in the company of people who kind of know a bit about who you are, but you realise that you have more in common with people at conferences who you see once in a blue moon than often the people at work who are in the office like next to you. So it's like one of those moments of like, seize the moment. But do you want to say a bit, Rhiannon, about what you do and where you're based?
Yeah, I'm based in Birmingham. I work mainly for Woodbrook, which is the only Quaker study organisation in Europe. I also, through Woodbrook, work with the University of Birmingham. So we partner to offer research degrees. So I work with the University of Birmingham Quaker Studies postgraduates quite a lot. And I also do a certain amount of freelance work. So I do writing and research independently of that as well.
Yeah, no, that sounds terrific. And it's certainly, and you're not alone in this, but that sense of multitasking, that sense of sort of working for this employer, that employer, having, you know, getting, it's great experience, but I know that sometimes it can also feel a bit sort of, you know, feel a bit sort of nomadic sometimes. That's the profession, I think.
I think it is. Yes, people talk about the gig economy, but mine's more of a patchwork career. Yes.
Yeah, and the work on Quakerism, because I follow you obviously on Facebook, and you do some phenomenal work, including publications. Do you want to say a bit about some of the work? Because I think you had a book out, was it, in recent months?
Yeah, so Wes Daniels and I had a book out in November last year. So that's an edited collection called The Quaker World, which obviously is quite an ambitious project to cover all of the things that happen with Quakers in the whole world. So there are 61 chapters in that book, with contributors, some academic contributors, some contributors who are ordinary Quakers, people writing about their own faith or analysing it, looking at the history and what happens today. So yeah, that was a really ambitious project. And we started in 2018, and we'd made a plan, because I'm in the UK, Wes is in North Carolina in the US. We'd met once in person and then made a plan for a second in-person editorial meeting for November 2020. So the plans kind of went haywire for obvious reasons. And it took us maybe a bit longer than we'd hoped to get through all the work on that. But yeah, that did finally come out last year, which we're very pleased with. It is quite expensive because books from Routledge and publishers like that tend to be quite expensive, especially in the hardback edition. But hopefully it's available through university libraries and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's always lovely when those sort of collaborations happen. And I think also that, you know, although obviously lockdown has had its many drawbacks, it also did kind of make the impossible possible in terms of those sort of collaborations, because I was finding that I was, you know, one moment I'd be having a Zoom meeting with a colleague who was like literally like just down the road, but the next moment somebody in New Zealand or Canada, and you're thinking, well, actually, whereas once upon a time, you know, I'd think, oh, I'll wait for that person in New Zealand or Canada to come to the UK, or, you know, me to come to them and maybe, you know, meet up, do a recording and so on. So with publishing as well, there are so many potentials. And so are you really happy with the product, with the end result?
Yeah, I think there's loads of great stuff in there, and we were really happy to get that really international group of contributors. Of course, when you publish something like that and then someone says, it doesn't cover this, the index doesn't even include so-and-so, you think, well, we'd better get on with the second edition. Yeah. But I think we're going to give ourselves a year or two before we start that.
And I think also that's the way, and I think often with PhDs, there's a trick, isn't there? Because sometimes people might say, oh, I'm not ready. It's a lifetime's work. And, you know, maybe in 5 or 10 years' time, I'll be ready. You're thinking that's not the way things go, because you're never going to have the definitive perfect work. And if, as you say, you submit something and then you think, oh, there's actually far more work that you can do, or we'll actually think, well, that's the next stage in the process. And, you know, so in that sense, it's a journey that has hopefully lots of publications along it and lots of, you know, symposia or conferences. But the idea that it's all going to be a completely like definitive, it might be definitive at a certain point. But as I discovered many years ago, when I was, often like asked to write on a certain film, and then you'd find that by the time the book comes out, whereas it felt really innovative and you were like, the only person writing on, The Passion of the Christ or whatever it was, by the time it comes out, you suddenly think, people might think, oh yeah, but there's another 30 books that have just come out. What makes yours so special? You thought, well, when I wrote it, the other 30 books were not known to me. So, that's the only way you could proceed, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And you have to draw the line somewhere. And I say to PhD students sometimes things like, well, stop there and leave the rest, all of that other question, leave that for the next book you're going to write. You have to draw a line somewhere in order to actually finish a project.
Yeah. And was your PhD in this area? Was it in Quaker Studies?
Yeah, so I did my PhD at the University of Leeds with Rachel Muirs and Mikael Burley. And that was it's called a Wittgensteinian investigation of Quaker uses of religious language. So very much looking at that question of how Quakers talk about God.
Oh, because I'm doing a module on death and the afterlife, and we always talk about Wittgensteinian language games and the sort of idea of, what does death mean? And, and Wittgenstein always seems to come into that in some capacity. So that's a wonderful sort of interdisciplinary kind of work. And that was obviously within a sort of what, theology, religious studies framework?
Yeah, so I think I called it philosophy and religion, which I think was Mikael's idea probably. So kind of bringing those things together, and it's not quite traditional philosophy of religion, which tends to be concerned with the existence and nature of God and the existence and nature of evil and those sorts of questions, but definitely studying religion in a philosophical mode as much as a theological one.
Yeah. And in terms of the, so obviously that's your sort of the academic journey. So you studied at Leeds for your PhD, but where did the journey start for you? So where are you from originally?
So I grew up in Watford, which is just north of London. One of the final stops on the Met Line, if Londoners know that. That was my beginning.
Yeah. And so what about your first degree?
So I went to Nottingham for that. So my first degree was joint honours philosophy and theology at Nottingham.
So, and of course, as is always the case, we obviously know all the same sort of people because the network, it feels, although geographically sort of disparate, I think, as I always find when we're sort of looking for external examiners or we're looking for people to collaborate with, you kind of realise that everybody knows everybody. It's that old game of that used to be called like 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon or something. But in the world of theology and religious studies, I think it's more like 2 degrees. Yeah, and as obviously this is a nostalgia podcast, it's always very great to sort of find out about the steps sort of taken, so how did you end up where you are now? And so obviously your background is very much obviously in philosophy and the study of religion and theology and so on. Do you want to say a little bit about things like earliest memory? So you grew up in Watford. So what are the sort of the things when you were growing up, maybe in terms of study and books or maybe film or music? What are the sort of the things that really stand out from your childhood?
So probably mainly books. I was into reading and even into writing from a very young age. My mother tells a story about having to describe the shapes of letters because I insisted on writing things down before I was really confident about reading. I guess one of my earliest memories is being at school and having a reading lesson, and the teacher held up this book that said blue, and she pointed at it and said, "That says blue." And I sat there and thought, "Of course it does, you daft woman," because I'd picked up some of those basics already. And then at school I was very into reading. I did have some problems because I didn't want to read the things that the teachers thought I should, and my mother had to come in and say, "Of course she's not reading that, she's bored, you need to give her something harder if you wanted to read it." And I remember reading, my parents were quite big on reading and reading with us as children. So I remember my parents reading aloud to us, my dad reading Arthur Ransom and Swallows and Amazons and The Hobbit. And I enjoyed Tolkien, and I read Lord of the Rings before I was out of primary school. So I was quite into reading and some of those particularly fantasy books from quite a young age. And Yeah, less into television and music. We didn't watch a lot of TV, although we were allowed to have News Round and Blue Peter. So I remember those quite clearly, and a few other things. Yeah.
Because it's funny, because my own children, I think at school, they must watch it from like the previous day. They watch News Round. So I think, oh, John Craven's News Round. That was sort of like what I grew up with in the 80s. But it's actually really interesting because my children, my eldest is 11, and yet they're doing things at primary school, certainly in terms of maths, because that was never really my thing. I was always more of an arts and humanities person. And suddenly when you realize that your children sort of eclipse you and they're doing things at primary school that I don't even remember doing at secondary school, I sort of think, wow, and I sort of feel, there's a point when you think you can't actually help your own children because they're sort of on their own trajectory. And it sounds like you were on an amazing trajectory in, reading those sort of stories in an age perhaps when, as I look back, I don't recall, in outside of the sort of things that we had to read in school, and I don't recall reading all that much at primary school, but aside from the things that we had to read, I don't recall being all that great a reader. Lots of, like, remember, like, all the, was it The Three Investigators? It was a very sort of had Alfred Hitchcock's name to them. It was like a detective series in the sort of Hardy Boys or Nancy Drew sort of vein, but yeah, I sort of look back and think, yeah, maybe I should have read more, or but there's all, still, even to this day, I always sort of feel there's far more books out there than I can possibly obviously pick up, and it's like there's a point of what do I read first, and do I read political biographies or do I read novels, or often maybe like film screenplays or adaptations of films, that kind of thing, but it sounds like you're streets ahead of where I was in many
There are
ways.
still a lot more books than I'll manage to read in a lifetime, though. It is a problem.
And it's quite interesting because obviously this is an audio interview, but we've both got lots of book shelves behind us, which is, that's just the sort of the nature of the kind of work that we do. But you mentioned as well about working with other PhD students. I mean, do you find that you're somebody who is always reading lots of journals? Do you always find that you have this sort of insatiable appetite for continuing to read, perhaps more sort of academic stuff, really. But do you find that you have an opportunity to do that, to share it, and then to impart that to your students, which can often be a really, one of the joyous things of teaching, that sort of enthusiasm of saying, look what I've just read, and then, conveying that to your students.
So I do try and read journals and things, not always everything I'd like to because of that time constraint factor. But one of the things I really enjoy about working with PhD students is when it goes the other way and somebody comes to me and says, look at this amazing thing I found, look at what I've read. And actually, I probably take book recommendations from them as often as the other way round. And so there's that kind of building up a body of knowledge together and exchange of information and ideas and trying to work things through alongside each other in that supervision process. As someone's working on a project, I'm learning with them. And I have some PhD students who work in fields that maybe they're in a joint supervision arrangement with someone else from a completely different field. And I find that I'm learning all sorts of things in that situation as well.
Yeah, and it also makes you rethink, doesn't it, the sort of the nature of education? Because I'm not sure when I was at school, and I was talking about this with somebody else, maybe it was in another podcast, about whether were we at school to sort of to learn, or it was about conforming or being a good citizen, and all, and in a way it's all of those. But it really sort of struck me that the sort of the, often the more didactic approach that I often associate with education, is not a model I use, because obviously I'm used to standing in front of a class of students and I'm capable of talking for 2 hours, but it's not the best, model. And sometimes when you're sharing with students or and learning from them, and that sort of dialogical process, I find, it's sort of a very different and quite an organic way of doing things, but streets apart from perhaps what I ever expected education to be all those decades ago, certainly when I entered this profession.
I think there's been quite a big shift. I mean, I think at Woodbrook in that kind of Quaker setting, maybe people have been doing that sort of interactive and experientially focused education for a lot longer. And so growing up in a Quaker community, I'd kind of had experience of that and brought some of that into my approach when I started teaching university students and other groups. But yeah, there is something about that, even if people know nothing about the topic before you start, the kinds of questions that they ask and the approach that they take. You give them a problem, you lay out a situation and say, how would you approach this? What kinds of things do you think people do in this situation? And actually, what they come up with can be hugely insightful, even if they're starting from really zero previous knowledge.
Yeah, and I find as well that, you know, in a way, it's a wake up call to me, because I'm aware that sometimes, like, some of the examples I might give are sort of within my comfort zone, and you suddenly realise that you're referencing things that maybe they, you know, when they weren't even born. I was talking to my students about something yesterday, and I referred to a journal or a film or something that sort of came out at the end of the 90s, and suddenly realised, of course, that, you know, my class, they weren't born then. So suddenly it's like, okay, I need to find, there needs to be that point of connection. So it's, you're kind of thinking on the spot and realising that the things that maybe you got away with a decade ago kind of don't work anymore. So, you know, that is that working both ways kind of approach that is
and,
the best.
Other things kind of become canonical. I was talking to an A-level student the other day who was looking at philosophy stuff, and she said, oh yes, at school they watched The Matrix, or at least an extract of The Matrix, because that is now the canonical film for setting out that set of philosophical problems about epistemology and how do we know things, how do we know we're not in the matrix. And you know, two generations ago you would just have read Descartes, but now you watch The Matrix, and that somehow that piece of pop culture has become the canonical reference point for that thought experiment. And I think that's really interesting. And it made me stop and look back quite how old The Matrix is and go, actually, that was a long time ago. But I watched that when I was an A-level student as well. And it has become the example that people use for talking about that particular problem.
And it actually came out a week to the day before my PhD viva back in 1999. So that was the last film I'd seen before I had the viva. So I was suddenly aware, like, I was going into the viva thinking, you know, if I was doing the PhD now, then, you know, suddenly that would probably or quite possibly be one of the texts I'd use. And actually, it's quite funny, because when I saw The Matrix at the cinema a couple of years ago, I was struck, first of all, by how analog it is. Like, they're still using, like, modems, and they're using CD-ROMs, and they're using, you know, physical phones. But also, when the woman who took my ticket at the, I say the woman, I mean, she was probably like late teens or something. And she said, I said, oh, I saw this when it came out. And she said, it came out in the year that she was born. And I thought, oh, okay. So I suddenly, like, yeah, you're right, the things that enter the canon, and it's almost as though you don't realize it's happening, and suddenly the things that you know, it's always exciting, the things that you might expect people to be talking about are not always the things people are talking about. And so again, it's back to what we were saying about learning from your students, that the things that their reference points sometimes are really insightful, and have often sort of said a whole lecture I've done, or seminar anyway, completely off course. Have you, as well as The Matrix, have you had similar experiences?
Yeah, suddenly that, you know, a key question that suddenly you spend half an hour on, and that takes the whole thing not quite the way you planned it. But yeah, I think it can be really useful to include that kind of pop culture in teaching. I remember using a clip from one of the Avengers films as a jumping off point for a whole lecture on religious freedom and the nature of freedom in ethics. And so, yeah, there can be ways to kind of work together with a group of students to think, what are they interested in, and how can we build that into the topics that we need to cover for the syllabus?
Yeah, and I mean, I often mention this in the interview, but I've always kept a diary. And so, you know, having a record of all of those sort of things, and almost like the origin point of something, like, this is one, you know, and the random things that you mentioned that suddenly take on a whole new significance years later, when, as you say, they sort of become part of the canon, whereas at the time you might have just thought it was just another film or another book or whatever it might be. You didn't realize that it would have that sort of cultural cachet. But what about you? I mean, have you always sort of, like, kept a record, a diary or a journal of all the things that you do? I suppose in research you've always got a record of sort of maybe the books that you've read and so on, but, you know, does that play a part in your work?
Yeah, to some extent. So I mean, I remember at primary school being encouraged to keep a reading record and having to write down all the things I'd read, which I think sometimes teachers were a bit skeptical about, because I was reading things that were not what they expected me to read. But then that dropped out quite a lot. And although obviously I would have kept a record of the academic stuff I read for an essay or for a research project, I didn't keep a record of my kind of casual reading for a long time. And I haven't got a good record of like which films I've seen, for example, which sometimes I regret. And I've tried, you know, there are various websites where you can try and log these things, but it doesn't quite take somehow. But I did a few years ago, a friend recommended Goodreads to me, and I'd been trying to log my reading a bit with an eye to reading more diversely and to thinking, am I reading a wide range of authors? Am I reading people who are writing from different cultures and different countries and different backgrounds? So I started using Goodreads fairly seriously in, I guess, about 2016, 2017. And that's been really interesting, actually, to be able to look back and say, not only how many books do I actually read a year, and I kind of knew I read quite a lot, and now I can say I've got a spreadsheet and on average I read this many a month, but also to look and see what genres do I read, what kind of authors am I reading, and trying to Goodreads at least does let you log all the books you read, so you can log the academic ones and the poetry alongside the genre fiction and the whatever else it is you're picking up at the library. So I have been doing more of that kind of record keeping recently and finding it really interesting.
No, that sounds amazing, actually, because it was also I'm guessing that that's something that's potentially shareable, is it, with others? So it's actually something like there's a communal dimension that you're inputting material that other people can also share.
Yeah, so Goodreads is essentially a social media site. So it's a social media website run by Amazon. So that tells you that it kind of succeeds in selling books, whether or not we think we should buy them from Amazon. But so when I put up a review there or I rate a book, that is visible, and people who follow me on Goodreads or just somebody who's looking at the book can look at the review and say, is this the kind of book I want to read? And that can be quite useful. And there is that, it's not a huge amount of interaction. It's not as immediately interactive as Twitter or something. But over time, there is some interaction and you get a kind of friends feed. And if you're following people on Goodreads, you can see what they're reading and their updates about the books they've read, which can be quite interesting in terms of kind of getting a feel for maybe what's popular at the moment. Or if I see a book coming up over and over, I think, ten different Quakers are all reading this book. Maybe I'll read this book because it's going to become one of those cultural reference points.
No, that sounds incredible, because I'm very aware that I'm sort of posting lots of, you know, like, because I obviously watch lots of films, and I suppose I justify that as part of my work, but I perhaps would do that anyway. But also I regret the fact that, and you know, because technology is such that we can easily take multiple selfies and put them in a communal space. But we didn't have that capacity 20 or 30 years ago. So I'm sort of really conscious that, you know, there's a part of me that wishes I'd had those sort of records. And obviously we didn't. There's no point. You can't worry about something that, you know, it didn't exist in those days. But it's more a case of, well, I can start now kind of thing. So I'm very aware that I'm sort of creating this, I suppose it's a digital footprint, and you never quite know who might use it, if anybody, in the future, but I'm very conscious of the need to have that, and that need to share. And as you say, you can use it for great academic purposes as well, but also that sense also of wanting to know what other people of like-minded folk are doing and what they're reading, and kind of being part of that conversation. So it can be, although overwhelming, I'm sure, in many ways, but you know, it also gives you a good sort of sense of the zeitgeist, I suppose.
Yes, and I think that social media and things can be really good for that, for getting a feel for what's going on. And even if you're not participating actively in a conversation, I mean, I've been seeing lots of posts about the Roald Dahl situation, for example, and the what should we do with these stories that don't say what we now think is right, but how do we handle that? What's appropriate for maybe a course on the history of children's literature? And what do we want to be published as fresh to be given to children now? And those are quite different things. And yeah, it's really interesting just to be seeing that conversation happening. And, you know, in this world of Zoom, I don't have a water cooler to go and stand by and hear the casual chit chat. So social media fulfills a lot of that function for me. And just getting different people's opinions and seeing what kinds of questions are coming up can be really interesting.
You've got this scenario whereby as I find with my students, I'm presenting text that maybe 5-10 years ago didn't seem an issue, but I'm just aware that, and I suppose perhaps I predominantly have female students, but aware that the language of books, some of them might be in translation, but were very sort of masculine, lots of references to mankind. I do a course on Death of God, so lots of 1960s theology, and the language is not all that inclusive. And I probably 10 years ago probably kind of would have passed me by to an extent. It doesn't anymore. And I get very self-conscious and turn it around and have really good conversations with the students about, you know, what how they feel about the nature of the language that's used. But it's those sort of conversations that, you know, were once upon a time kind of taken for granted. And, you know, you used the word canon earlier, and that's an important word, I think. It's sort of almost like that's the okay. That's the, you know, it's almost as though that's the way things are done and you don't question it. But the Roald Dahl situation is very interesting because you've got, you know, I can see it from both sides. I can see absolutely the need to, you know, use language that, but, you know, perhaps that is not appropriate by today's standards. But on that basis, everything's going to be rewritten. I kind of feel that you get into all sorts of issues of censorship, and I don't really know how this is going to play out.
Mm. Yeah, and I think it's quite different to have the historical version as a canon that undergraduate students might read, as opposed to a canonical book that parents expect to be familiar with, but also are presenting to children who are not yet of an age to really have developed those critical thinking skills and to understand that this isn't a new book, it's a book from a historical period. So I think there's something about what context you put things in. So actually, my wife and I watched a film on Disney Plus the other day, and it was the original version of Lady and the Tramp. And they'd put a warning at the front that said, this is the original version of the film. It contains things that would not be appropriate by today's standards. And it is. It's got these scenes that are really horrifically racist, particularly towards Asian people, where they're caricatured as these Siamese cats who have, really nasty habits. And so there's that. At what point do you decide to put a warning on the front? Would it even work if you put a warning on the front of a Roald Dahl book that said, by the way, there's a racist depiction in this story? What would children make of that, and how would parents discuss it with them? And you know, it's one thing for us as adults to be watching that on Disney Plus, and we can have an adult conversation about the time period in which this film was made and what it means for us today. But actually, how do you introduce those things if you're a parent working with children? And also as an educator, if you're a primary school teacher or a secondary school teacher, or even working with university students, how do you introduce those things? How do you make sure that people have age-appropriate tools to understand what those changes in society are and how that's happened and what the truth is as we understand it today?
Yeah, and you're dealing with so many different cultural shifts and the resistance to that. I remember I was at the cinema once, I think it was the Dambusters, and there was a warning at the beginning that there's a very offensive word, I think a name of a dog or a character, I can't remember. And so this was all flagged up, and I thought, okay, fair enough, it's good that they did that. But then I heard people, and people who were in the audience tended to be older, I think they were sort of people perhaps in the 60s and 70s, and they were having this conversation about, oh, you know, we'd all this political correct nonsense and all the rest of it. And I thought, well, actually, for this very reason, we need these warnings, because I think that the idea that you let things go unchallenged, it might have been okay for them in their generation, and there are lots of like white men, but actually the some of the depictions will be offensive, maybe not to them, but to others, and I think that you just have to have that awareness of, you know, of inclusivity. So I do think it's very difficult, but, you know, and also there's the irony that you put on a Roald Dahl book, this contains racist expressions, and that in a way also, of course, means, you know, are you sure you want to buy this kind of thing? So it's interesting space that I don't recall anything quite like this ever, really, where, you know, you're at the point of thinking that, you know, quite canonical works or sort of, you know, great works of literature, children's literature, you know, where actually you might have second thoughts about whether it's even appropriate to purchase that for your children. anymore.
Yeah, well, and you know, we mentioned Arthur Ransom earlier, but there's a character in Arthur Ransom whose name is Titty, for reasons I've never fully understood. And even, you know, Enid Blyton or something, you find not just characterizations but words where the meanings have changed, and the queer old tree now sounds quite different, although those words have often had double meanings for a long time. So yeah, it can be really difficult, and how you navigate that. And I think it is about giving people tools to understand the situation and to make good decisions for themselves. And it's not like we're going to be taking all of these books out of the academic libraries where there are original versions kept and things, but thinking about what's being published now, and like if you're doing a film showing now, how do you frame it so that people can understand what's going on and how the culture has shifted around it? Yeah.
And also, and absolutely, because I'm thinking of even like Jane Austen adaptations that I've seen in the last few years, where they, or Charles Dickens as well, where you'll have maybe an entirely ethnic minority cast, or you suddenly, you know, you change all the contours. So it's not historically accurate, but it's sort of very much. But the whole point is that it suddenly fits and chimes with now. And often they're better films in many ways because they're refreshing, and they're not trying to sort of, you know, just simply redo. You know, the idea that somehow you're going to have this accurate 19th century or 18th century, whatever it is, you know, kind of depiction. Anyway, it's all made, you know, every film is sort of its era and looks like it's from that era and says something about the expectations and the mores of the time. So that might be a very interesting way to go sometimes. You've got the set texts.
Dickens is an interesting example because he himself recognized the anti-Semitism in some of his depictions, for example. And so there is that process of authors recognizing the problems and maybe in some cases even making changes themselves. And if that's the direction they were moving in, maybe there's a kind of openness to that. They didn't know where the process was going to end up 100 years later, but actually they were open to that kind of learning and changing and developing the stories in that sort of way.
Yeah. So tell me, Rhiannon, what inspired you to enter academia?
Oh, that's a good question. I think wanting to read and write, yeah, it's good to have a space where those skills are valued. I remember having a conversation with my mum about careers, and I said, well, you know, I really want to write. And she said, well, maybe you need something to write about, and academia having that research piece as well. And I think I was motivated by wanting to understand questions in philosophy and religion, actually, and wanting to understand why do people believe different things? Maybe what is the truth about the nature of the universe and those big questions, but enjoying that kind of philosophical method of asking questions and trying to look deeply into things, trying to look at things from lots of different perspectives, trying to be logical about things, trying to say, how does this idea follow from that idea and that idea? So I was particularly attracted to studying religious studies and to exploring philosophy. And then one way and another, I ended up in academia. I didn't always plan to end up in theology and religious studies, actually. And after my undergraduate degree, you were talking about the sexist language that some theologians and other people in that field have written. And actually, after my undergraduate degree, I was so fed up with sexism in theology and religion that I said, I can't be doing with all that. And I went to Leeds to the Centre for Interdisciplinary Gender Studies. And my master's degree is gender sexuality and queer theory. But I still had that interest in religion itself. And my MA dissertation was about feminists and how they use religious language, and precisely some of those issues about, can you name God as a woman? What happens if you stop naming God as a man? What other kinds of images can you use? And so I went away and did the religion, the gender and sexuality piece, and kind of came back to study of religion, and particularly to that focus on language through that process. So yeah, there were several steps, and then I didn't get funding for my PhD the first year I wanted to do it. So I kind of had a year out where I was, well, I was not very well, but I also tried lots of different jobs and lots of different voluntary work, including getting involved in some interfaith projects and things, which I found really nurturing and really interesting. So then I brought that into what I wanted to do in the PhD when I did get funding for it.
Yeah, and I mean the passion really comes through in what you're saying, but also the evolution of the journey, and there's a part of me sometimes, and I feel a bit guilty sometimes, and I think I'm kind of channeling the stuff that I did 30 years ago or was taught 30 years ago, whatever it might be. But also when I think about it, certainly when I'm teaching, the examples I'm giving are very much fresh. They're very sort of based on news events, or it might be films, or whatever the module might be. But then I'm very aware, and I always think, you know, what would my tutors from all those decades ago? And sometimes I'm still in touch with them in many cases, so they do know what I'm doing. But that's always the interesting bit about, you know, what the people who inspired you or inspired me, what how they would feel that you've almost like they've given you the structure that they've started you off on the journey, but you've moved the journey in a direction that maybe neither you nor they could ever have anticipated.
Yes, and I think there is that that kind of process of almost of wanting a student to come up with something new and to move beyond what you've done. And I've certainly had that experience with PhD students or other people who've used my work, that somebody else takes something I've written or an idea I've had and applies it in a new way or challenges it, which is brilliant, or adds something to it in a way that really makes it fresh. And that can be an incredibly instructive process. And you get that kind of feeling of, I suppose, being part of a chain of building knowledge gradually over time. And you make your contribution, but it's intimately linked to the things that came in the past, and it can be used by the next generation, the next people to come along, to do something else with it as well.
Absolutely. And do you find, I mean, are there particular teachers, maybe at school or lecturers at university, who inspired you, who perhaps in some cases you might still be in touch with?
Yeah, so there are a few people who I'm still in touch with, people at Nottingham and several people from Leeds. I think people who particularly inspired me, so someone who's sadly not with us anymore, Michael Mack, taught me at Nottingham. He came in as a Jewish studies lecturer during the end of my time at Nottingham, and had just such an incredible knowledge. And he used to, you know, some people prepare lecture notes and some people have a list of bullet points. And he would just walk into the room and he'd tell a story for an hour. And I was in awe of that really rich knowledge of being able to give the detail, but also the overview and the passion and the why is this interesting. And so when he said, oh, I had to skip the lecture on such and such, and in fact it was on feminism in Judaism, I went to him and said, you skipped this lecture, but I want to know, can I write a dissertation? And I was really lucky to be able to work with him for one of my undergraduate dissertations. So yeah, some people like that, and then other people who've been really movers and shakers in my discipline, I'm lucky to still be working with. So Ben Pink Dandelion, for example, who did lots of foundational work in the sociology of Quaker studies, I now work with every day. And in fact, my next meeting today is with him this afternoon. And so really being able to work with people who are central in the field in that kind of way is excellent. And that ensures that conversation goes on and we go on sharing ideas and inspiring each other as we work together, which is a really great opportunity to have.
Yeah, and it's always, I find with my own students as well, when sometimes they realize that, of course, some of the people whose books they're reading that they know, and they, or they're doing a presentation and the person who they may be quoting is in the room, or you know, if it was one of my modules or something, and is that sort of that strange sort of dynamic of suddenly realizing something that never happened at school in that sort of sense, when when you know, in a way, you always had that sort of distance from all the people you were studying, and suddenly at university you realize that they're the people who walk the corridors where you are. So it's a very, I mean, I suppose I'm used to that now, you take it for granted, but I remember when I was an undergraduate, I'd always feel if I was ever using the books of my tutors, I always wanted to sort of almost like say, according to the eminent blah blah blah, because you always like wanted to say, wow, you know, you're not just the person I'm quoting, you're in a special category. It's funny because that was my way of navigating the fact that I was, you know, in awe of the people in many cases who were inspiring me, and in many respects, of course, still do.
Yeah, and having that feeling of personal connection. I remember going to a conference where someone I'd read as an A-level student, actually, and been really inspired by, and then as an undergraduate decided I just didn't agree with him at all. But I went to a conference where he spoke, and I was like, wow, I disagree with you completely, but 16, 17 year old me is completely blown away by this opportunity. And it's really interesting how your ideas develop over time like that. And as you say, you kind of become used to being part of that community. But yeah, it is a very special thing to be able to be working with people whose ideas have changed your mind and shaped you in that kind of way.
Yeah, and it's happened to me, obviously, I'm not going to mention names, but I have been in that situation where you meet your heroes, maybe at a conference, and you suddenly, and you say to them, you know, gosh, I've been using your books with my students for many years, and you expect them or hope them maybe that they'll sort of be sort of really excited or interested, and their response perhaps is a bit more, should we say, underwhelming, and you think, oh, you know, and suddenly you think, oh, I kind of wish I hadn't met you in many respects. So you, but you're right, but that is part of the journey, that as we evolve, perhaps also the, maybe not the people themselves, well, obviously we'd like to think that everybody evolves, but in that sense it's the interpretation that we bring to their work that evolves, and sometimes you're not on parallel paths anymore.
Yes, that you were kind of started off supported by them, but then you go off in your own direction and you've moved beyond the work that they did in some way.
I suppose the elephant in the room when you're talking about, you know, religious studies or theology and so on, but the role of religion and faith, because in your case obviously Quakerism is very important in what you do, and I'm guessing that a lot of your students as well may also be, am I guessing that they're Quaker as well, but how do you find the sort of interplay between teaching on religion and coming from a faith perspective as well? Do you find that sort of works very well? Because I find where I work sometimes it always works with the students, but it's people outside the discipline who always seem very suspicious and sort of imagine somehow that if you're teaching religion you're doing something almost like you're proselytizing. And I was, and asked questions like, are you a priest? And I think, you know, why would you ask that question? It's a very interesting, but the students always find that very funny, because it's not, you know, they don't belong in that kind of world. But how does that play out for you?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I remember when I started my undergraduate degree, people would say to me, in an interfaith setting, actually, a Muslim man heard that I was going to study theology and asked, are you going to become a priestess? Which was a very interesting question for someone who was a Quaker, but also just beginning to explore paganism at that time. And I was like, well, maybe I am, or maybe I already am a priestess, or I'm not quite sure how to answer this question. And I do find that people have assumptions about the relationship between faith and one's academic study when there is that overlap. And there can be issues about, can you stand back enough from it? So sometimes teaching within your own faith community, actually you can get a bit cynical. So sometimes you see the communities that are having problems and are struggling in some way because they're the ones who come for help. And so then you can get a skewed view of what's happening in the community as a whole, and you're kind of only seeing one part of it. I think probably theology is more open to that as a discipline than some other disciplines. So my PhD supervisor and friend Rachel Muirs is able to be openly a Quaker and a Christian theologian. in a way that Ben Pink Dandelion, for example, publishes as Pink Dandelion for sociological academic work and as Ben Pink Dandelion for internal Quaker documents. And I haven't felt the need to do that. Now, possibly I should have done, right? There's a kind of brand name optimization argument for splitting off academic work and popular work on Quakerism that's meant to be accessible and aimed at an internal Quaker audience. And then again, maybe publishing poetry, or I also published a novel, and maybe that should be under a different name again. But the decision that I've taken, partly for simplicity and partly for integrity, to say I'm a whole person who does lots of different things. So the decision that I've taken is to publish all of them under the same name, which does mean sometimes I spend a lot of time explaining all the different things I do, but also means that people who look for one also find the other. So if you go looking for my academic work, you'll also find out that I write fiction and that I write accessible things. And in several cases, that's had quite a good synergy. So I had two academic books in the Brill Research Perspectives in Quaker Studies series, and both of them I took kind of the core of the research and turned it round into an accessible book, which I published with John Hunt, Christian Alternative. And that's worked really well in terms of both having that academic credential, getting the peer review, for example, which is a process I've learned a huge amount from, but also being able to make things available in a paperback book that doesn't have footnotes that actually you can buy and get change from a tenner, which is not usually the way with an academic book.
Yeah, and you're right, because sometimes I've thought about doing something in a more sort of fictional vein or using diary stuff or something, and people say, oh, you know, just change the name or use a pseudonym or something. But I feel, and that feels very odd, because I'm so used to being in the mindset of almost like taking the credit for, you know, if I'm doing something, it's transparently me. So to use a false name or something kind of feels an interesting sort of approach to take, and I can see why people do it, but also sometimes you kind of want that common link between all the different sort of the sides of what you do, so that people can cross-reference and so on. So yeah, I can see the dilemma. Yeah. As we start to wrap up, Rhiannon, you know, when that whole thing about, you know, in the context of nostalgia, like the way that negative experiences can sometimes have the effect of making you come out more strongly on another side, that sometimes you think, and it can happen in an academic context, that there's a challenge, like a thesis, that you think, okay, this goes against the grain of what I was expecting. You know, how can I redo this, or how can I, you know, how does it change when you look back and think, yeah, it was all for the best. So it's that whole question about the way sometimes that we navigate the past, and I suppose I'm getting at whether sometimes we're inclined to want to try and almost like rewrite, revisit, reframe the past in the light of all the things along the way, which at the time felt quite serious obstacles. But from now you think, ah, they were challenges, I overcame them.
I think there's some of that. So there is always a tendency to make things into a narrative. So actually, some of the questions you've asked me today about what set me on the path to the career that I'm now in, well, actually, I can tell you, here are things that put me on this path. But if I'd had a completely different career, if I'd become an archaeologist, actually, I can point you to all the things in my early life and the interests I had as a teenager and a young adult that would put me on the path to becoming an archaeologist. But I didn't study archaeology, and I'm not an archaeologist, although I did write a novel set in the Neolithic, so maybe I'm a little bit an archaeologist. But you know, I can tell that story in different ways, and I can tell a story of, oh yes, there was this obstacle and then I overcame it. But actually, sometimes there were obstacles that I didn't overcome, and who knows what effect that had on my career. So actually, I went to Nottingham. I went to Nottingham because I didn't get into Durham. I didn't get into Durham because I had a cold the week that Oxbridge applications were due, and my application was too late for that. So I didn't even apply to Oxford or Cambridge. If I had, or if I'd got into Durham, or if something else had happened, who knows what different path I might be on. So, you know, something quite minor. I had a cold one week when I was a teenager. it could have changed the course of my life in really quite unpredictable ways with how things turned out. But you don't know what other stories there are.
No, and I kind of believe maybe because I spent a lot of time doing a lot of origin with my students, sort of lots of early church stuff, because it's almost I feel in some ways that sometimes we all sort of come around and we do ultimately, if there are things about which we're passionate, we end up doing them anyway, but maybe in a different form. So maybe if you'd gone to any of those other institutions, you may not be exactly where you are now, but your set of interests would perhaps be the same. So you might be doing a sort of a variation of what you're doing now, or maybe the same thing that you're doing now, but simply in a different setting. But you never know, because if you hadn't gone, if you'd gone to those other institutions, you would have been influenced by other teachers, and it's inevitable that you would have followed a path that may be similar, but not identical.
Yes, and I could have had a very different path, and if I was interested in Quakers, I might well still have ended up working with Woodbrook, because actually there aren't that many institutions in that specific space. So yes, you don't know, and you could have ended up in a similar position, as you're saying.
But that's a perfect opportunity for me to ask the question about what it is that maybe when you were young, you imagined that you might be doing. I don't know if your 5 or 15-year-old self had an idea about what you might end up doing.
Yeah, so I think my younger self had a few ideas. So there were a few years where I wanted to be a vet, which would have made particularly my grandmother, who'd wanted to be a medical doctor and was put off it at a time when women were not allowed to be doctors, very happy if I'd gone into something in medicine. But I dropped that idea quite quickly when I found out how much maths you had to do. But I did, I had this idea about being an archaeologist, and I think, I still have a strong interest in that stuff about the distant past and how do we know about it? How do we understand cultures? And actually, a lot of what I have done about the study of religion is about understanding how groups of people work, how communities interact with each other, which is really relevant to some of those questions. And the other idea that I had as a youngster was that I wanted to be a writer. And I remember borrowing a book from the library about how to get into poetry, which said pretty much in as many words, you can't make a living from poetry. You're going to have to do something else as well. So it didn't exactly put me off writing, but it did give me a bit of a reality check about the need to have some kind of day job alongside it.
Yeah, and it's always interesting, isn't it, how you've got sometimes the younger self almost like in conversation with the present self, and the present self in conversation with the younger self, and all the way sometimes just reflecting on all those sort of the various pathways and scenarios. But in a way that you may not have been a writer of poet. Well, I well, maybe you are, but actually you're a writer, but maybe just writing in a completely different area to that which maybe you anticipated. But you are in a way still fulfilling that dream.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, and one more question for you, Rhiannon. Would you consider yourself to be a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
I guess probably more looking forwards, in my own life, obviously in my academic work and in my interest in history and things, I do look back a lot, but in terms of thinking about my own life and making decisions, I'm really a looking forward person and thinking about what are the next steps. I'm very much a planner and trying to work out this is the ultimate goal, but what are the small steps that lead up to that? So, overall, a looking forward sort of person.
Well, fantastic. Thank you, Rhiannon, for being my guest this week. That was brilliant. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. It's been good to talk to you.